Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this our 11th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my absent colleague Peggy Wright, home recovering from the flu, and with help from our webmaster Haiwan Wan, at home recovering from jet lag in a recent trip to China, and assistance from our reference coordinator Brian Carson. Daniel Peach, here taking pictures, designed the posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is a native of New Albany, Indiana, where his family has lived for more than a century. Growing up, he wanted to be an archaeologist. He was most influenced by his parents and grandparents, who encouraged his early reading, and his great-grandfather, who gave him a prehistoric stone axe when he was just 3 years old. His interest in the classics came from reading a child's version of the Odyssey, and he became interested in underwater archaeology when he saw Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments and wondered if there were remains of Egyptian chariots and Israelite footprints on the floor of the Red Sea in modern times. After a BA at Yale, he received his PhD in archaeology at Cambridge. His fieldwork has included studies of Bronze Age Scandinavian watercraft, prehistoric sites in the Ohio River, the Roman villa of Torre de Palma in Portugal, investigations of the Delphic Oracle and other Greek oracle sites in Greece, Turkey, and Albania, and recently, deep submergent surveys in quest of ancient shipwrecks in the Aegean and Mediterranean. His research has appeared in Antiquity, the Journal of Roman Studies, and the Scientific American, among many others. He's been profiled on NPR and in the New York Times, and his fieldwork has been featured on the Discovery and History channels. At the University of Louisville, where he serves as Director of Liberal Studies, he teaches classes in archaeology. He's a former Panhellenic Teacher of the Year. When not teaching or researching, you can find him rowing, an avocation he first pursued at Yale and Cambridge. And he's the founder of the Louisville Rowing Club and the Greater Louisville Rowing Foundation. In 2009, Penguin published the paperback edition of his acclaimed Lords of the Sea, the epic story of the Athenian Navy and the birth of democracy. Please give a warm welcome to John Hale, who will be talking tonight about discoveries underwater in the Mediterranean. John.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be way down here in Bowling Green, far, far from the banks of the Ohio River, and to have had a wonderful Mexican meal here. I just didn't realize that Garcia's was a purveyor of such great food. So thank you for the warm welcome, thanks for the dinner, and thanks to all of you for coming out. This is a Faraway Places series, but the world I got into, underwater archaeology, actually deals with the faraway at our doorsteps, lakes, rivers, coastal waters where you may go to the beach. As soon as you get under that water, you are in a faraway world. I understand that tomorrow Jacques Cousteau's granddaughter is going to be here talking about that world. Jacques Cousteau is the climax of a long, centuries-long procession of people who tried to penetrate that faraway world and make it possible for people to work there and to explore it. He and his colleague, Émile Gagnon, were the inventors of scuba. Before Jacques Cousteau, if you wanted to be underwater, you had to be hooked up to the surface with a long hookah, one of those tubes with the pressurized air, and you pretty much had to walk around upright in what looks like a space suit with a gigantic helmet, some puffy bodysuit. Jacques Cousteau was the one who liberated humans underwater. As he said himself, and it's my favorite Cousteau quote, "On land, we are all nailed to the earth by gravity. Underwater, humans become archangels and can fly." And so I'm taking you to a faraway world where you can fly, but I'm also taking you to my corner of that faraway world, the Mediterranean Sea. I call this talk In Poseidon's Realm. Poseidon's realm comes as close to us as the Gulf of Mexico, but it's wherever the sea and the oceans extend. Poseidon was a Greek god with a fairly big portfolio: horses, earthquakes, but above all, the sea. That's his realm. And we're going to be looking at his home waters, the waters of the Greeks and the Romans, where he was worshipped either as Poseidon by the Greeks or Neptune by the Romans. And he always carried his trident with him to show he was a sea god. The trident is a fishing spear. And the reason it has three points is parallax effect ensures that fish never are where they look to be when you stare at them from a boat. And so you got three chances with that spear. That's why fishermen like those trident spears. But chosen for an initial image, another one of my worlds, rowing. I did write that book, as you heard, about ancient Greek democracy. The Athenians decide to make themselves and their city a great sea power. They did that with galleys, these ships called triremes, three-decker ships, with 170 rowers in each ship, packed in on these three levels, each man pulling his own oar. Those citizens, many of them very poor, who were suddenly defending Athens against King Xerxes of Persia and other invaders, they suddenly were the principal bulwark of the city, and they demanded full citizen rights. And that is what made Athens a real democracy. And both Plato and Aristotle, who hated the navy and didn't think much of the democracy either, felt that sea power and democracy were somehow inextricably linked, and both very destructive of proper government. This is the man that got me underwater. He is Odysseus, shown here in a Roman mosaic, chained to the mast of his ship. He's homeward bound from the Trojan War. This is a real story. It's about 1200 BC, tail end of the Bronze Age. And while all of the Greek heroes of Troy had different fates in getting home, Odysseus takes the prize for taking the longest. Homer says the Trojan War itself lasted 10 years, and Odysseus's wanderings at sea took him 10 years to get home. As you heard, my first book of my own was a child's version of the Odyssey. I fell into that book the way you fall into a pond. I never wanted to get out of it. I just wanted to find those seas. From my house, you could see the Ohio River with the barges pushing their way down to New Orleans. I just wanted to go with them. I wanted to get into the sea, find things underneath the sea, whether it was Pharaoh's chariots in the Red Sea or shipwrecks or maybe even Odysseus's ship. He lost so many on the way home. There was surely some trace of one or the other of them. Here you see his men rowing him along. They've got wax stuffed in their ears because there are dangers at sea, and that's something we always have to remember every time we suit up with our scuba gear and plunge into that faraway world. Everything from the bends to creatures that are happy to look on you as lunch and certainly consider themselves way above you on the food chain. These are the dangers. For Odysseus in this picture, the danger is a pair of beautiful women. At least they look beautiful from the waist off, up. From the waist down, they are seabirds, and they are carnivorous. But they have a beautiful song. They're called the sirens. And they sing, and they lure mariners to jump off their ships, swim to their rocks. They die on the rocks and then are eaten by these sirens. Anybody been to the Amalfi Coast or Bay of Naples? Well, you may have seen those two rocks that were the inspiration for the sirens out there in the pounding surf. So I wanted to follow Odysseus, and he opened up for me this whole world of the underwater exploration. I got interested in sea battles. I got interested in that great city of Athens, the city of Greece's golden age. Don't ask me why people like the Spartans. I just don't get it. None of us would be here. There wouldn't be bookstores if the Spartans were in charge. They hated learning. They hated any kind of academic thought or philosophy. They hated poor and ordinary people. Slaves were supposed to stay in the fields, and proper men lived in the mess hall and defended their country. I like the Athenians with their ships, their democratic ideals, and my favorite corner of real history, as opposed to Odysseus' history, was the Battle of Salamis, where the Athenians led a little force of just 300 ships to try to face and destroy the Persian armada of 1,200 ships that King Xerxes of Persia had brought all the way to Greece in order to enslave the Hellenic people. A clever Greek named Themistocles lured the Persian armada into the narrow straits at Salamis near Athens, where their great numbers were of no use to them, and Greek daring and Greek science and Greek oarsmanship destroyed the Persian hopes of conquering the world. Here's a God bless National Geographic artists. Here's King Xerxes of Persia seated on a knoll that you can look at today. You can't climb it because it's a restricted military zone, but that's the Straits of Salamis. Modern city of Athens is off to the left, out of the picture. And Xerxes had his seat set up on that hill by his slaves so he could watch the battle like a spectator at a play. He thought it was going to be the greatest victory in Persian history, their first really big victory at sea, and he'd be there to watch it. And he's got secretaries here who were supposed to note down all the Persian captains of ships who did particularly well so the king could reward them later. Didn't turn out that way. He saw his fleet smashed, he saw his naval hopes shattered, he saw the great invasion of Greece grinding to a halt here on the fatal waters at Salamis. And when some of his Phoenician captains came up and complained, he just had them beheaded. He was so furious about the whole outcome of this. And this is a place I'd love to get underwater and see what's left there. Many things drawing us under. But in addition to these warships with their oars and their rams, I realize I've got a pointer here, oars and their rams, most of the shipping was in fact commercial. Greece was participating in the world's first big global market. Silks were brought all the way from China. Incense, which was burned in every temple, on every altar, throughout the Mediterranean, came from one little corner of the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen, where you got the frankincense that is mentioned in the nativity stories in the Bible, and which is all brought up from there by ship or by caravan. Ships carrying foodstuffs, grain from as far away as the Crimea. Socrates got his daily bread from Russian wheat or Egyptian wheat, not from Greek wheat. So I was interested too in these ships, these wonderful cargo ships filled with things from faraway places. Tin from Britain even to make the bronze because the Mediterranean people had run out of it themselves. Ivory from Africa, lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, amber from Sweden. It was an exciting thing for me to think of. All of that wealth of the world poured into the Mediterranean and carried from one end to the other in these Greek and Roman ships. And I was most interested by the fact that it seemed to be left out of my school history books that the great classical civilization, to which I was first introduced through pictures like this. This is the Erechtheum, the statue of Athena on the Acropolis at Athens. Those maidens are Caryatids, maidens of Athens, serving the goddess, holding up the porch roof of her temple. This is what I thought the Athenians were all about, and what they themselves thought they were about. Balance, order, beauty, architecture, philosophy. I was kind of shocked to learn that in the century in which the Parthenon was built, the companion temple to this, if the Parthenon is indeed a temple, probably more a war monument than a bank, the Parthenon is mentioned one time in all of the surviving Greek literature in the century it was built. The navy, the ships, the naval base at the harbors of the Piraeus, it's mentioned all the time. My favorite quote, and the only one in which the Parthenon is mentioned, is from a long-lost comic poet named Eupolis, who said of the wonders of Athens, including those on the Acropolis, "O Athens, queen of cities everywhere, how fair the Piraeus, how fair the Parthenon, how fair the navy yard." Yeah, the Parthenon is just the filling in a sandwich made up of ships, seafaring, naval power. We need to get things the way they saw it if we really want to understand their true worldview. And so we get underwater. This is the kind of thing you can still see in the Mediterranean. It's often billed as a Dead Sea. Certainly Cousteau was appalled at the deserts in the Mediterranean. It's losing its oxygen, it's being overfished, and yet we could still see corals, sponges, fish big and little like these rays. Truly a thrill to be under this water in Poseidon's realm for me, first time I donned my scuba gear and went in the Mediterranean. And from that Mediterranean have come treasures which help us see both the trade in wonderful art that went on in the Greek and especially the Roman period, During the Roman period, Greece had become a backward and impoverished nation, and statues like this were ripped from their places in Greek homes and sanctuaries and public spots, carried off to ships and shipped off to Rome, and a lot of them sank. So we have this little Apollo who was found in the 19th century by helmeted divers in a bay called Piombino on the west coast of Italy. And this fabulous vase found very near that Apollo statue. This was made in Roman times. It comes from the east. It has Eastern gods and goddesses, Near Eastern gods and goddesses, the Great Mother, Mithras. It's emblematic of those Oriental religions that were carried across the Mediterranean Sea. Ultimately, Judaism and Christianity were carried on those ships as well. Nero's wife, Poppaea, was interested in converting to Judaism. We don't often hear that side of her character. Christianity, of course, landed in Italy with Peter and with Paul and spread like wildfire, but the initial movements of these religions were in the ships, and their symbols, like this sacred silver vase, were also part of those cargoes. One of the really exciting discoveries came when a free diver named Stefano Mariottini in 1972, on his August bank holiday, not even with scuba, just with a snorkel and a little spear gun, was down at the toe of Italy at a place called Riace. He went out and he saw this arm sticking up from the sand 25 feet below him through the clear water and assumed it was a murder victim. But when he swam down and fanned the sand away, there was this statue, and ultimately two statues, larger than life size, the finest bronzes ever discovered. You know, 100 years ago, we didn't have bronze statues of the Greeks. All the ones on land had been torn off their pedestals and melted down, since bronze, unlike iron, is infinitely recyclable. It's more like gold and silver in that respect. So all the great Greek bronze statues, and the Greeks valued their bronze statues a lot more than their marble ones. The only one we had was the charioteer at Delphi, who'd been buried in a landslide, and the looters of the Roman period and later couldn't find him. But these masterpieces, they were lying out there. They were in Poseidon's keeping, waiting for intrepid divers to go down, find the lost shipwrecks where the Romans who'd been carrying them out of the Greek world ran afoul of storms or pirates, and the great treasures were lying on the bottom. These are hyper-realistic in a way that nobody ever dreamed of till the time of scuba, and we could begin to unpack this amazing treasure house on the bottom of the Mediterranean. Just about 3 years ago, anybody recognize the unmistakable face? Caesar Augustus. The baby face, the wide brow, that haircut. Never a beard, never grow up. He is astride a horse. The horse is missing. He was found off the coast of Greece. He was probably going the other way. When the Romans began to export their culture, their society, Romanitas, being Roman, worshiping the emperor went along with that. And so there were statues and shrines and public monuments all through the new Roman Empire where statues of the emperor were needed. I'm not saying it's a flattering image, but they didn't care about being flattered. They wanted to be recognized. So whether it's on their coins or in their personal statues, you see the Roman emperors as they are, because wherever they traveled through the empire, they wanted everyone to recognize them as they went. These bronze statues, hundreds of them now on the bottom of the sea, represent that first softening up wave so people could see their emperor, their godlike ruler, and be impressed when he came himself. I'll buy a beer for anybody who knows where this is. But I'm sure that I'm looking at a room full of people, some of whom have been to this cape, this ending of the land and beginning of the sea. Any guesses? Anybody ever been to Cape Sunio at the tip of Attica? Hands high, please. Temple of Poseidon. Got one well-traveled man here on the front. This is where, as the Portuguese would have said in another context, we live where the land ends and the sea begins. That's true of all the Greeks. Their land is a rocky mountain chain. The islands of the Aegean are just the tips of submerged mountains. The sea penetrates into every corner of Greece. And these are the great cliffs that end Attica, the home territory of the Athenians. There's one little image up there, one figure that's a Greek archaeologist, underwater archaeologist Alexis Katsambis, thrown in there for scale. We don't often remember how heroic the Greek landscape is, the incredible relief, the cliffs and mountains shooting up straight from the water.
But this picture explains why we got so many shipwrecks. There's a happy little white sail floating along on the water. Everything looks like glass. But the cliff itself is a guarantee there's trouble ahead. Precipices coming up out of the sea breed winds. The drowned mountain chains ensure that wherever you are blown in the Aegean or anywhere, mostly in the eastern Mediterranean, you're going to run into some land pretty soon. If you get in a big storm in the Atlantic or the Pacific, you just run with it. Chances are you won't hit anything as long as you can stay afloat. Not true in the waters of the Greeks. They're always liable to shipwreck. They had to have a tremendous amount of lore so that they could avoid the storms brewed by these sort of dangerous precipices, cliffs, mountains that were all around their sea. There's another thing that carried things to the bottom, and that is that the land itself is active. The most tectonic real estate in the world is in Greece and Turkey. Africa's pushing north, Italy's shoving in from the west, the Anatolian plate is crunching in from the east, and the result is the Balkans, the rise of islands in Greece. Greece itself is all, I don't know, are you all in karst country? I know I passed Mammoth Cave. We are up where we are with Wyandotte Cave. I thought maybe I'd passed out of it south of Mammoth. Greece is that way too. Lots of caves, lots of limestones. Properly, it's the floor of the old sea. But the vice, the tectonic vice of all these converging plates have pushed Greece up. And yet at the same time, crumbling Greece, some shorelines will tip and go down. Others will be suddenly up in midair. If you go to the island of Crete, at one end is a Roman port 30 feet up in the air with the holes in stones for the ships to tie up, now the height of a three-story building above the modern seawater, because that end of Crete is coming up. The other end is a Minoan palace, Katalzakro. Its lower portions are underwater because that end of the island is tipping. We're looking here at a scene that is a place where St. Paul visited when he was in Greece. We're at the port of Corinth, a little place called Kenkriae, looking out at the Saronic Gulf. There's a drowned Christian church. It's a little less than 2,000 years old. It's got a nice Roman mosaic in it, the area up here in which you would have had an altar and celebrated the communion feast. It's underwater now because of this tipping. So more and more we're finding that there's an underwater world that is not just shipwrecks, but drowned settlements, drowned buildings, even drowned parts of cities. This is a mosaic found at this place, Kenkriae in Corinth. A little difficult to see with this bright light, but we're looking at someone who actually drew the port with its colonnades and its buildings, made a mosaic of it. That's underwater now, bearing tribute to what the place looked like. We're here in the Bay of Naples. You're looking at the wall of a Roman house with a little pilaster coming out. When Vesuvius blew up, it sank cities. Baia is the name of this city. And here we see a scuba diver tank on the back, a Roman mosaic. It's only about 15 feet below the surface, but there's a whole drowned town there, comparable to Pompeii and Herculaneum, but now under the sea. Lots of pots have been found under the sea, like this one. They bear tribute to the Greek obsession with wine and the great Greek trade in wine and in the pottery in which to drink wine. We want to get into this way of thinking the Greeks had about it. Just think of the way we are with coffee and tea, beer. There's special mugs, special bottles, special cups to drink it out of. You know a teacup, you can tell it from a coffee cup. It's the same thing with wine. Every part of the wine drinking ceremony had its own pitchers. This is a crocker. This is for mixing the wine with the water. Shocking, they had good wine and they always diluted it. That way you could drink longer without getting drunk. So that's kind of an overview of the kind of things you find. Let's look at some specific sites now. Artemisian was a place that yielded extraordinary statues back in the 1920s. This is a beautiful port, a fishing harbor, on the north end of the great island that's today called Evia and was called in ancient times Euboea. Euboea means good for cattle. It's off the eastern coast of Greece, and at the northern end of that long rocky island here is this little bay. Fishermen went out from here in the 1920s, cast their nets, and drew up two unbelievable bronze statues. You probably know this one. He's kind of iconic. He is
He's rearing back to throw something. Those who think he's Zeus think it's a thunderbolt. Those who think it's Zeus's brother Poseidon think it's a trident. But you should see him like this. This arm is out of proportion on the original statue. That's too long to be anatomically correct, but it looks right when it's foreshortened and he's facing straight at you. Also, whatever it is he's throwing wouldn't have been in the way of his face if it's the trident. And in fact, if you look through his hand and you look at his finger there, I had a javelin thrower from one of my classes who came along and looked at him. He said, he's throwing a spear. It can't be a thunderbolt. It is Poseidon. He's rearing back. He's ready to throw with this wonderful thing. This is a 5th century BC, Golden Age of Greece, sacred image from one of the Greek temples. This one probably wasn't taken down until the Christian period. Once, starting with Constantine, the Roman emperors first permitted Christianity and then converted themselves, all these great Greek and Roman sacred statues became so much junk, and people were free to pull them out of their temples and either melt them down or set them adrift on the sea as loot. Even more interesting in some ways is this little Hellenistic horse and rider. We're not too far from the bluegrass here. The big events, of course, were chariot races, but they also had horse races with jockeys up. And here's a little boy, maybe an African, who is a slave boy, the jockey, and we're right at the end of the race. The horse is exhausted. Let's come in and look again. First of all, at our god, who I do think is Poseidon, and then the horse, the jockey, every fold of the horse's skin, the flaring nostrils, the open mouth as it is gasping and leaping to cross the finish line, and the jockey looking across to see where the competition is. We know he won, because this is a victory statue. This is what was put up by the owner of the horse to celebrate the big win at Olympia or wherever this horse won. And here we have this fabulous snapshot in bronze of a moment in ancient Greek athletics, courtesy of its being preserved under the sea. And here's the brand. One of the things I always remind my students in underwater archaeology courses is you'll find things underwater you never find on land. Archaeologists need to get underwater if they want to see the full range. Here's the brand of a horse. It's a goddess with wings. She's holding a wreath. And her name is?
Nike.
Victory. Nike. Victory. She's got a shoe named after her now and a whole line of heavily branded commercial stuff. But here she is. This horse was of the Nike brand. The farm and the stud where he came from was probably called Nike Victory. And this was the brand that was on his hindquarters, faithfully reproduced for us by the ancient artist in bronze. Now, it's not just in modern times with Jacques Cousteau's Aqualung and scuba that people have been getting underwater. Ancient people formed guilds of divers. A corpus is not only a body, you've got a corpus, but a body of human beings, a company of human beings, a guild who all belong to one trade would be a corpus. And the very unflattering name that the Romans gave for these divers was urinators. Urinatorum, the guild of the urinators. Why? When you're diving, when you're doing free diving and you're not in a suit or anything, and actually, as friends of mine say, there are two kinds of modern divers, those who take a leak in their suit and those who lie and say they don't. There's tremendous pressure on your body. And the fluids in your bladder are pushed out of it. And apparently the divers told this to other people who thought it was very funny and just decided to call them basically the pissers. So we've got a guild of Roman divers here. They are of the Roman port Ostiensium, of the people of Ostia. And you can still visit Ostia today if you go to Rome. It's a ghost town at the mouth of the Tiber. People go to Pompeii and Herculaneum by the millions. People go to Ostia by the hundreds. If you want a real experience of a ruined Roman city, just get on the little tram that goes out of Rome, go to Ostia Antica, ancient Ostia, go on a golden evening, you'll have the place to yourself. You can stroll around, see monuments like this, and see the mosaics in front of the great merchants' houses where the stuff was offloaded from the ships, and each mosaic tells you who brought the wild animals for the shows in the Colosseum. Well, that shop had mosaics of elephants. Who brought the timber? There are mosaics of trees. Who brought the wine? Mosaics of amphoras. These divers were part of that nautical world of Rome.
and they found treasures. When a ship sank, if people knew where it were, the divers were hired to go. How deep could they go? 100 feet. Was it worth being a diver? If you went more than, I think it's just 12 feet down, you got to keep half of the value of what you recovered. You bet it was worth it. I mean, here was something where even the poorest person who learned the skills of diving and holding their breath found it worthwhile. And finally, how long could they stay down? We don't have records for ancient times. We know it was a big deal. We've got descriptions of how they would hold stones against their chest when they dove in so they could get to the bottom almost immediately, how they smeared their faces and eyes with olive oil, lots of tricks of the trade. When the last of these free divers came into contact with Europeans who had stopwatches, these are Ama pearl divers in Japan, those are women, or pearl divers in the Caribbean, African, mostly men. All the guys with the watches, and we're back in the 1600s now, gave the same result. I know it sounds incredible, 15 minutes underwater. Not just sitting and holding your breath, but working at great depth, under pressure. When I was a student studying this for the first time, an undergraduate, I was told, this is just proof you can't trust ethnographic evidence. You can't trust anecdotal evidence. It's physically impossible that anyone could stay under 15 minutes. And I was cited to me that the world's record, back in my long ago day, was a Navy SEAL sitting in the deep end of a swimming pool who managed to stay there for between 5 and 6 minutes. You know, it's up to 13 minutes now. There is a new extreme sport, holding your breath underwater. All you need to do to see what human beings are really capable of is make it an extreme sport. You ever seen those log things, the loggers on cable TV? How do they do it? I don't know. But if it's a competition, people will find a way. So we're up to 13 minutes. We're within 2 minutes, and that's just people holding their breath and holding onto a line. But clearly, these societies, like the Romans with their corpus urinatorum, this went on for centuries. It was passed down, father to son, mother to daughter. We get great skill and great capabilities. And here we see, you see the statue here? This is Zeus. This is Heracles with his club. These guys would find bronze statues under the sea, put nets around them, and then the people on shore would haul the nets in and recover the statues from the shipwrecks. And then the diver, who had gone down, located the statue, put the net around it so it could be hauled back, would get half the value of the statue. A very good living indeed. Now in the modern world, we find how rich that load of cargo is that's on the bottom of the Mediterranean. It's not just statues. Whole temples were disassembled. Capitals, column drums, architraves, pediments, and sent on ships with the parts labeled so they could be reassembled at the point of landing. This is off the coast of Tunisia, Mahdia in the southern Mediterranean. And a whole garden full of urns and garden architecture and mosaics was being shipped from Rome south to Carthage, that ancient African city of the Phoenicians, the city that launched Hannibal against the Roman Empire, the city that was the Punic side of Rome's Punic Wars. Well, the Romans initially destroyed it and sowed salt, but then they thought, this is a good harbor. So they resurrected it and made it a big seafaring center. And this big shipload of statues, urns, it sank almost within sight of the coast. And it was an area that the divers couldn't get to. And this stuff was too heavy to bring up. So it remained for the 20th century to find. Things don't always end up well preserved under the water. This goddess's head shows the results of being underwater in the Mediterranean, where there are actually sea creatures that eat marble. Remember, every seashell is made up of calcium. There are sea creatures that know how to extract trace amounts of calcium from the seawater itself. There are others that will go along and bore into any piece of limestone or marble that's under the water and get that calcium into their system by eating it. And her poor face is pockmarked with the holes of these animals that have gotten down there and begun to eat. And finally, we even find the military side of Rome under the water. This is a catapult that was on board that same Mahdia ship. They must have been planning some wars down in the desert against the as yet un-Romanized tribesmen. And the evidence for that is on this Mahdia, M-A-H-D-I-A, Mahdia shipwreck. I mentioned the wine. It's not just that they transported wine by sea, but the sea was tied up in the myths of wine and of the wine god Dionysus, or Bacchus. Dionysus, he's the son of Zeus and of a mortal woman. and he came out of the east. He was on a ship. His ship was captured by pirates. He was kept for ransom because he looked like a rich kid from a rich family. He warned the pirates, "Let me go, or terrible things will happen to you." But they laughed at him. He was not only a kid, he was a weak, pasty, unathletic kid. Well, he turned them into dolphins, and you see the pirates transformed into dolphins on this wonderful Athenian cup of a little before 500 BC. He took over the ship. He made his magic grapevine grow off the mast as if the mast were the trellis in a vineyard. Grapes in bunches appeared on the ends of the vine. And in this ship, Dionysus sailed from island to island, from coast to coast, spreading the religion of intoxication. Partying, putting on masks and pretending someone you're not. The dark, the irrational, the frenzied element of life. You've got to like a religion that makes this a god. Wine, drunkenness. And his ceremony is to get the wine and get drunk yourself. Men and women. If we take what wine was to the Greeks and compare it to our world, we can't find any one substance that will match it. If you put all the caffeinated drinks together, coffee, tea, chocolate, none of which were available to the Greeks and Romans, if you throw in all of our soft drinks, all of our hard liquor, all of our wine, all of our beer, and then throw in cigarettes, marijuana, you're still not where they were with wine. Because wine was a sacrament also, and we have that corner of it left in our religion. So most of the ships we find as archaeologists lying around in Poseidon's realm, they were wine freighters. And the amphoras, the double-handled transport jars in which the wine was shipped, are the single commonest object to find in the Mediterranean. Jacques Cousteau invented the aqualung in 1947. By 1950, he was leading operations on a shipwreck he'd seen outside Marseille Harbor at a little reef called Grand Conglué. There were, in fact, two Roman period wine freighters stacked on top of each other. They both hit the reef about a century apart. Thousands of these amphoras, these pointed end, double-handed transport vessels. That's Jacques Cousteau. There was an archaeologist named Benoit sitting on the deck. It was assumed at that time that learning to dive was such a specialty that no archaeologist would ever be able to do it. It was only 10 years till George Bass took some lessons at the Philadelphia YMCA and led the archaeological excavations at Cape Caledonia on a shipwreck in Turkey. But at this stage, this is in the early 50s, everybody just thought, there'll be divers, there'll be archaeologists. Poor Benoit, the archaeologist, sat on this deck watching the divers below him through a closed-circuit television. They had lights, they had a TV, and he could shout at the divers, "Don't touch that! Don't touch that!" But of course, they'd pull it right out. He was impotent, helpless, furious. They found one of these in which the stopper was still intact. And when they shook it, they could hear stuff inside. So Cousteau said to Benoit, "Are we going to try it or not?" And Benoit said, I just don't think this is a good idea. Who knows? It could be toxic. But Cousteau was made of sterner stuff. He got a hypodermic, inserted it at the edge of the stopper, shoved it in, drew out black stuff that looked like old crankcase oil that hadn't been changed long enough. The cameras were there from French television to show this. So they poured it into champagne flutes, this horrible black gunk, and stood facing the cameras. And as an archaeologist, I'm ashamed to say, as they did their toast, Benoit threw his over his shoulder, and Cousteau drank his to the bottom and said, "It's the nastiest thing I've ever had in my mouth. But to taste the vintage of the year one." Spoken like a true Frenchman. Here's one of those amphoras down in its context. On the seafloor, the two little handles are to carry it. This is their only function when they're made, is to be ship transport containers. And they're stacked up in rows by the hundreds, by the thousands, in the big Greek and Roman transport vessels. And they're very hard to steer, and they've got small crews. They're a little bit like our gasoline tankers today, tiny crews, and often getting into trouble. Think of all the problems we've had, Exxon Valdez on. So they sink a lot, and as I said, this is the commonest thing to find on the bottom of the sea. But Jacques Cousteau is one of the people who started the science of studying amphoras. Each shape is different. They're like car models. They tell you where they were made. They tell you in what decade they were made. It's amazing to be with one of these amphora experts who can take an amphora like the one you just saw and say, "Oh yeah, Rhodes, third quarter of the second century BC. and they're right. They just know how to read it. So we can date all of these, right? And some of the amphora makers had brands like Nike that they put on their amphoras. This is an early use, maybe the first use we have in human history, of commercial establishments representing themselves by logos. This is the logo of a wine seller and amphora maker named Cestius. You can tell he's used S-E-S as the first letters of his name and as his logo. But here we have it. He knows that it's Poseidon who conveys his wines around the world, and so Poseidon's trident is on there as part of the logo of this early wine house. Here's a typical sketch after we put down our grids so we can, on a sort of checkerboard, locate every amphora and restore it to its places if necessary. We'll take off all the overburden with airlifts to get the sediments off. Archaeology underwater is actually less destructive on land. On land, we got to use shovels and trowels, and those sharp steel edges are inevitably going to scrape, cut, or if it's a shovel, even smash the artifacts that you are trying to look for. It's just going to happen. Underwater, with the airlifts, it's like an underwater vacuum cleaner. It's a long pipe with suction in it. The overburden, the soil, the sediments are just lifted away from the site. You never touch them. You just steer that mouth of the airlift around. You clean off the site, expose what you need to, photograph it, draw it as these thousand or so amphoras of the Halonissos wreck in Greek waters, and then you're ready to lift them. Sometimes the amphoras preserve underneath them the ship. This is real rare in the Mediterranean. There is a wretched creature in the Mediterranean and in most of the world, salt water, oceans and seas, that destroys wooden ships. Anybody familiar with this horrible species? It's called a ship worm, but that's not right. It's like slugs in your garden. It's a mollusk. Only unlike the slugs in your garden, it's still got a little vestigial shell on the tip of its tail, and that shell is just perfect to be a rasp. And it can rasp its way into ship's timbers, and it can start to grow. The ship is now its shell. The ship is its burrow. It's defenseless without that. It can grow a foot and a half in a month. Ships could be riddled with these teredo, as they're called. Pteridon navalis means the thing that wears away. You very rarely find wooden ships from ancient times because if they're exposed on the bottom, that teredo shipworm, that teredo mollusk, has riddled the ship's timbers and they've collapsed and crumbled away. But under one such wine amphora ship, the Kyrenia ship from Cyprus, the excavators, Michael Katzeff, now deceased, his wife, my friend Susan Katzeff, found that the amphoras themselves had been such a massive cargo, they spread out over the ship and prevented the teredo from getting to the timbers. They raised about a third of the ship. They made copies of all of the timbers, the ribs, the keel, the planks, the mast step. They reconstructed the ship. You can go to Greek waters and see this reconstructed ship from the time of Alexander the Great. And they, Susan even had local potters make all the amphoras so they could put in duplicates of the amphoras and sail around, restaging these voyages. And this is called experimental archaeology. You build a piece of technology, you see how it works. Most of what we know about ancient sailing is from this ship, preserved on the bottom by the wine amphoras themselves. Then there were colonizing expeditions. Greeks getting out of Greece, I mean, they colonized all the way from Spain to the Black Sea. Here was a colonization effort to Italy. This was found off Monte Circeo. Corinthian helmet, look at what it looks like when it's cleaned up. All those incrustations under the sea actually preserve the beautiful metal. There are boars, wild boars, on the cheek pieces. This is what they look like. All preserved as new as the day that it came out of the bronze maker's workshop, thanks to it being underwater. Another site, off Sicily, a woman's perfume bottle. She was a Greek colonist from Corinth, headed for a new home in Sicily in the 6th century BC. Her ship sank within sight of land. Maybe the people made it, but all their gear and all their belongings went down in this ship. Italian archaeologists have been bringing up things like this little Corinthian perfume bottle, this child's toy. Another boar, but this time a little thing made out of pottery for a kid to play with. A lamp to light up the symposia, the drinking parties, without which no Greek man's day was complete. Symposium means drinking together. Lamps like this, filled with olive oil and the wick coming out here, decorated with high-class geisha girls of the Greek world. Hetaira is the name of one of these. She's a companion, and a little man erect and ready for action on the top with his drinking horn there. these lamps would allow the merriment, the wine, the sex, the good times for the men of the family to go on late into the night, they and their friends. And she's got her little cup reared back ready for a throwing game. They toss the dregs around at targets. Hours and hours misspent at these parties. But it is called symposion. Symposion is drinking, sim, S-Y-M, together. Sympathy is feeling suffering together. Symposion is drinking together. If you're ever invited to a symposium and they don't give you drinks, demand your money back because you have been defrauded. This is another reminder of things underwater you don't get on land. This is a 600 BC, 550 to 600 BC, Greek olive oil bottle. It had a cork stopper. The cork is still there. Nobody had ever seen one of these till this little colonizing shipwreck was found off the south coast of Sicily. And finally, most amazing of all, I know the lights make it hard to see. This is a basketry purse with a drawstring that belonged to a Greek woman and probably would have had her needlework stuff in it or something like that. Everything preserved, we can even tell the weave, because sand had blown over it or drifted over it on the seafloor. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before, preserved down there on the floor of the sea. Now, if I had to pick one ship, well, it's hard to pick one shipwreck and say it's the most important, but I'm going to give you two, my two candidates. First is a shipwreck from a place called Antikythera. Back in the year 1900, some Greek sponge divers, the guys who wore the big copper helmets and walked around like spacemen on the seafloor and cut sponges off rocks and brought them to the surface. Do not ask me to explain the economics of sponge diving. I cannot understand how a lot of sponges can support the unbelievable investment in gear, in human time, trouble, life risk that's involved in sponge diving. Sponge divers found this guy and others off this little rocky island where they were kind of caught by a storm and had to spend days. And finally they got bored, and being Greeks, they went down to explore the sea floor, knowing there couldn't be sponges, but just wanting to see. There were, as the sponge divers said when he came up, dead bodies everywhere. It was a big load of Greek statues headed for Rome. And here's the face of a philosopher. If you had a shaggy beard and it didn't look like your hair had been combed, that was the sign in the Greek and Roman world, oh, he's a philosopher. So just for all of us academics, we can remember that. Most statues we get on land have lost their eyes. It's rare for us to see a statue looking back at us. But the Greeks and Romans loved color in their statues. They would have eyes made of white paste, the irises, different colored precious stones. They would color the lips by having pure copper to represent the red of your lip. And sometimes they would even apply pigments to the bronze and certainly always to the marble to get a really alive look. Well, this philosopher comes off this wreck called Antikythera, A-N-T-I-K-Y-T-H-E-R-A. Kythera is a great island south of Sparta, south of the tip of the Peloponnese, very dangerous waters for ships. Antikythera, the place against Kythera, is an even smaller island and reef south of Kythera. Why am I making a big fuss? Because those sponge divers who brought this stuff up in the year 1900 brought up things that they didn't even know what they were, like this. This is a chunk of bronze, all concreted together. There was a wheel, that was easy to see. There were chunks of wood adhering to it. And everybody, it was too small to be a windlass or something like a pulley on a ship. They decided, well, it's a navigational device, like a sextant. It was found in 1900. It was put away and then re-looked again in the 1950s after the invention of something called the computer. Because you are looking at the world's oldest analog computer, and nobody knew what it was until we reinvented computers in the 20th century. This is what it would have looked like. You've got 40 bronze gears here with interlocking teeth. Each gear represents a heavenly body. The sun, the moon, a planet, the sign of the zodiac. And when you turn the little dial outside the wooden box, the wood would have hid the gears. They all move one notch, one day. This thing was created about 80 to 100 BC, probably on the island of Rhodes, where Cicero says people made astronomical devices of bronze. That's the only clue in ancient literature that they had something this fancy. We know that this isn't the only model because some of these were cut down from larger rings, larger gears, and have the writing for the larger gear in pieces across them. So a whole tradition, a secret tradition, a lost tradition of these computers. You're looking at a planetarium you can hold in your hand. You're looking at a series of gears that can show you the relationship between all these heavenly bodies on any night in history. And you can predict eclipses with it. You can say when Venus will be rising. You can say when a certain sign of the zodiac will be regressing. You know all those astronomical columns we have, or astrological columns? They're all nuts. The signs of the zodiac aren't in those months anymore. They haven't been for a long time. This device showed that. This device showed the slipping of the signs of the zodiac through the months of the year. So this is the single most amazing piece of technology from the ancient Greek and Roman world. A bronze computer. Where did we find it? A shipwreck. A piece of treasure. Is it the only one? Obviously not. But it was a secret thing. And that's one bad thing about the ancient world. They tended to keep big discoveries secret. They'd get it into their guilds, into their workshops. Nobody would find out about it. It was only these sponge divers who brought this corner of antiquity back to light. And then we've got one other contender to be the most important shipwreck. It's at a place called Uluburun, U-L-U-B-U-R-U-N, the Great Cape on the southern coast of Turkey. This guy, George Bass, the University of Pennsylvania archaeologist who learned to dive and led archaeologists underwater, and one of the many divers who worked with him, that's Faith Henschel, a schoolteacher of Connecticut, who along with a whole generation of people, after 1960, opened their morning papers, read about American archaeologists diving in the Mediterranean Sea, left their jobs as school teachers, physicists, whatever they were doing, took long vacations and said, we want to help. And Faith, I was with her at the National Meeting of Underwater Archaeology 2 weeks ago up in Newport, Rhode Island. She's still one of the mainstays of the whole project, and she is a New Britain, Connecticut school teacher who just has this alter ego. It's not Superman, and she's called Clark Kent in her school teacher life, but it's that kind of a field. And in archaeology, I don't think it'll ever happen again, that we will punch through to a new realm and all kinds of folks can stop being electricians and become MacArthur genius recipients because they figure out how to take ancient parts of ships and reconstruct the ancient ship. That was a guy named Dick Steffi, now deceased. That Kyrenia ship you saw, that earned him his MacArthur genius award, that he could reconstruct a modern ship from all of those timbers. So here we got the actors, some of the actors. This is the clue that there was a ship at Uluburun. In the time of the Trojan War, the Bronze Age, bronze and copper were carried around in ingots like this, big flat things with four handles, rectangular shape. This one was found by sponge divers who recognized from the underwater archaeologists drawing on table napkins in bars this shape and saying, if you ever see one of these, call us. Because after 1200 BC, nobody made these anymore. So if you see a shipwreck with these, it's not your average Greek or Roman amphora. You're looking at the time of the Trojan War, of Homer, the Mycenaean kings. You're looking at the time of the great 18th dynasty in Egypt. You're looking at the time of great civilizations all around the Mediterranean before the smash that led to the Iron Age. And sure enough, off Uluburun, in uncomfortably deep water, 130 feet down, comfortable scuba range for working ends at about 120, 130 feet down and on down, the anchors and the ingots of a lost ship from before 1200 BC. Before the end of the Bronze Age, we now know exactly, thanks to tree ring dating, the last timbers on this ship, which were the little fences along the edge of the ship to hold the stuff in storms, those were cut in the 1320s BC. Here's one of the divers bringing up one of the hundreds of these bronze ingots off the Uluburun wreck. This ship turns out to have been going from the Near East to Greece. There was enough metal on here to outfit an army with shields, spears, swords, helmets. Somebody didn't get their bronze. History was changed because this ship ran into that cape on a stormy night and went down to the bottom. So many firsts on this one cargo. You're looking at the oldest glass ingots ever found. You see that blue color? That's additions of cobalt. You got that rich blue. This is an Egyptian and Phoenician and Near Eastern technique. Here were blocks of it. There must have been a glass worker on board who was going to take these maybe to the court of Agamemnon at Mycenae and do wonders for the admiring the crowd and come home laden with Greek treasures, having shown off his skill with the glass. Here's a Canaanite goddess. She's bronze with gold hands, feet, and head. She may have been the ship's own goddess. Typically, the protective deities out at sea have usually been women. Aphrodite in pagan times, the Virgin Mary in more modern Christian times. and this Canaanite goddess, Astarte, Ishtar. Well, she didn't do a very good job. The ship went down, but she went down with it and was there to give us another nationality involved in the wreck. And then you're looking at the underside of a little gold scarab here. You all know what scarabs are, though, those Egyptian beetles. And on the flat underside, there would be inscriptions, prayers. Those hieroglyphs spell out the name Queen Nefertiti. This is the only gold scarab of hers ever recovered, because she belonged to a monotheistic, heretic family of pharaohs and one pharaoh, Akhenaten, and his wife, Queen Nefertiti. All this stuff was ruthlessly hunted down and destroyed, but this little gold scarab had somehow gotten onto the ship, was headed across the sea, maybe as a diplomatic gift to a Greek king or queen, and went down with the ship. And finally, we're in a bookstore. The oldest book in the world was on the Ulubaroon wreck. Now, when we talk about books, we can be kind of loose about it. Most of the ancient world got its information from scrolls of papyrus that were rolled up with the writing painted onto it with brushes, or on clay tablets that had been marked with styluses, with cuneiform, or some other script baked in an oven. But here's proof that in 1320s BC, people were making books. Technically, this is called a codex, a thing with a hinge and two flat rectangular surfaces. All around you are codices, books, and they're all descended from this one. Or at least this is their ultimate prototype that we find in the archaeological record. Homer mentions something on folded tablets that is very mysterious to him and his heroes. It's one of these. This is bone for the hinge. These are panels of boxwood. It's that dense wood that's still used for clarinets and things like that. And they're only about this big. This was found in one of the big pots on the Ulubaroon wreck. Can you see their indentations in what are in fact the covers of the book? That's where the message, the letter, the prayer, the bill of lading, that's where the writing was. It was on wax. These are two wax tablets folded together to make this book. The wax didn't make it. So although we have the covers, we don't know what the message was in the world's oldest book. We only know that it comes from a shipwreck, the Ulubaroon wreck. Now, the ships that I would most like to find as a rower are these triremes. My Greek history professor from Cambridge University days over in England was a guy named John Morrison. There's no full representation of one of these ships. They're described in the literature. We know what they did from descriptions of them. But they were so complicated and so big, nobody ever made an image of one that's come down to us. So John Morrison collected all the evidence, and based on his work as a Cambridge scholar, and I went and pulled an oar in his garden when he had a section of one set up near his swimming pool, this ship was built. It's called the Olympias. It was built and launched back in the 1980s. It's still around, but it's had to be repaired and replanked many times. But it's basically all guesswork. And one of my missions as an underwater archaeologist is to try to find some of these that went down. Thousands of them sank, rammed in sea battles, carried down by storms. We've never found one. Now, at the nose of the ship is a bronze ram. The ship also had an eye. The Athenians wouldn't let one of their ships go out without the eyes. They thought all ships were alive. And unless they had their eyes, they wouldn't be able to find their way through fog or through dark nights. They had sails, and here you see it coming at you with the eye and the ram, but oars were the real power. As I said before, 170 rowers in one trireme. Athens had 400 of these in its dockyard when it finally went under to the Macedonians. This is war on a gigantic scale. Athens was not a peaceful place with an olive grove, a white marble temple on a hill, and a lot of people sitting around debating ideal forms. Athens was a sea power, with the biggest navy and most powerful navy in the Mediterranean for many generations. This ram was found off the coast of Israel. It belonged to one of the Hellenistic kings that followed Alexander the Great, and based on that ram founded Athlit, A-T-H-L-I-T, in Israel. The bronze ram on the nose of Olympias was created. This is still plying the seas. There's talk about bringing it over to America in 2011. I hope it comes, but it's all guesswork. And I've been involved in expeditions on this Greek research vessel, which has capabilities to search with side-scan sonar under the water, with robots called ROVs, remote operated vehicles that are like dogs on long leashes, And the leashes have in them all of the cords that show you through transmission of video images what those robots are seeing on the bottom, controls so the robots can be steered from a man on the ship, and finally a submersible you can get under. The name of the ship is Aigeo. It's named for the Greek king Aigeus, father of Theseus, the guy who killed the Minotaur. Aigeus is supposed to have killed himself by throwing himself into the sea from Cape Sudio. They saw at the beginning the whole Aegean Sea is supposed to be named for him. Here's our little yellow submarine. And as a Beatles fan, I am thankful they painted it yellow. And here again, we're kind of touching Jacques Cousteau. This is made by a French firm called La Comex, C-O-M-E-X. Jacques Cousteau had some input into the prototype before he died. This is a submersible to take people down in the sea. It can get down to 2,000 feet. It can stay there with its batteries for 5.5 hours. You and the Greek Navy pilot, don't think they'll ever let you touch it at the controls, you are down in this bubble, this acrylic bubble like the front end of a helicopter, flying underwater. You may not be like Jacques Cousteau's archangel in your scuba gear, but you are in flight. Here's the bubble. I'm waving out. My little sock feet are here. Some people went barefoot. You can't have anything on your feet or you might scratch the acrylic. It's as pressurized as an airplane. You don't get wet. You don't get the bends if you come up too fast. But you're totally out of communication with the surface when you're down there. These things are going to get less and less used. They're going to be replaced by the robots. I'm deeply thankful that I've had about 12 five-hour shifts on the bottom of the sea in one of these submersibles. They're being retired now because they're dangerous. Unless there's another submersible around, and we never had one, if something goes wrong, it's all over. And there were some people in our group who just wouldn't do it. Also, they felt very claustrophobic. Nonetheless, when you're down there, you're seeing up close things that have been hidden to every eye but yours for up to 2,500 years. Here I am at 2,000 feet down. There is a Roman amphora broken. There it is on our monitor. We're going to download that when we get back on the mothership, 2,000 feet overhead, and show what we found. Someday, I hope it'll be a ramp. And in fact, a friend of mine has just sent me images this past month from Sicily of Roman rams and Punic rams, Carthaginian rams, from a big battle in the Punic War. So people are achieving the dream of starting to find these warships under the sea. It does suffer a sea change, as Shakespeare says in The Tempest, when it comes up. Here's all the incrustation over one of the giant amphoras we brought up using the submersible's grab arm of titanium. And it's going to take weeks to get all that off and see what the shape of the amphora is underneath. I recommended that our group use history to try to track down shipwrecks. Back in the years after 500 BC, the great Persian king Darius and his son Xerxes, whose image has been defaced here by the Persians themselves, they decided to invade Greece. They took navies along, fleets of ships, and a guy named Herodotus, who you see here, the father of history, a Greek who lived on the edge of the Persian Empire, tells us about a dozen different sites where storms or sea battles sent these triremes to the bottom. We had a Persian War shipwreck survey up and running for 6 years to go to every site Herodotus mentioned, follow the routes of the Persian fleets around from Turkey, as it is today, Asia, the north end of the Aegean, down to Greece, and check them all out to see if anything had been left. We pulled out our maps, we're on board the bridge of the Aigeo here, and we're deciding where to go and how to attack it. We found a fisherman who said that he'd found a helmet on one of these sites, and he led us to the place where his nets at 300-foot depth brought up a bronze helmet from about 500 BC. This could have been one of the combatants in the Persian Wars. We sent down the ROVs, the remote-operated vehicles, to look at it. They are, as I said, like dogs on leashes, and they are hunting dogs. And sure enough, it went right down to where he'd found the helmet and found this great big pot. That thing sticking out of the pot, which we could see on the screens up here. And by the way, if you want to be a professional on this, I was being asked what you should go into if you want to get into underwater archaeology. Spend a lot of time in video arcades. Because this guy, he's in his early 20s, youngest person on the whole ship. He's the only one with enough time wasted on games that his thumbs could handle the joysticks for the robots and make them do all their work. And if you make a mistake, they immediately broadcast it back because their eye is a video camera telling you on the ship that the idiot at the controls had just run it into the seafloor and kicked up a huge amount of sediment that will take a half hour to settle, or flipped it over on its back. Angelos could do anything with it, and he was the master. So consider some gaming as an essential element of underwater archaeology. He moved in close. Here's this pot. That black thing is a worm, not a piece of cassette tape, as I originally thought. And he reached in with the titanium grab arm and pulled out something in the pot. It is incredibly a spear point. The butt end of a spear, a spear butt spike, it's called a sauroter, a lizard killer. Every spear had an iron point on its working end and a bronze spike so you could shove it in the ground at night in your bivouac, sleep by it. Even Homer mentions these. And the warrior can leap up in case there's an alarm at night and the spear is up and ready to go. So this was very exciting to find. And let me tell you that if you are doing computer Google searches for spear butt spike, you get some pretty interesting sights. Ours had beautiful cast bronze decoration on it. This is what it looked like when it was all cleaned up. And to our amazement, remember, underwater things are preserved. In the hollow was the shaft of ash wood from 2,500 years ago, still preserved. So an incredible discovery, and probably spillage from one of those ships of the Greeks or the Persians, because we found this at a place where King Darius was said to have lost 300 ships in a great storm. Here's a warrior. There's the butt end of the spear with its sauroter in place. He's a hoplite, and this is part of his gear. We went back down for the pot itself. The submersible has a big suction cup on the end of its one of its other arms, and it can actually latch on to big pots and bring them up. It was brought up on the surface. We looked into the mouth, and out onto the deck slithered an octopus. And this explained how the sauroter had gotten into the pot. Octopi do sleep. They like to have a den, and they like to line up sharp objects in front of the den so predators can't get in without warning. And this guy was A, annoyed at being lifted from 300 feet up into the air, and B, he'd lost his prime guard at the mouth of his house. He was out on the deck. I'll go ahead. I lost all control here and didn't take a picture. We saw this one down on the next dive, and maybe it's the same guy. He looks kind of accusing. I want to tell you something about sailors. The cook was up from the galley, the Greek cook, instantly with his cleaver in hand, ready to cut the octopus up on the deck. I'm allergic, and B, it just seemed wrong. I mean, this was the animal that saved the spear butt spike. This was the animal that allowed us to get funding for the next year, because we had a big find on. And this is a rule of archaeology. This is the afternoon of the last day at sea. It just always happens that way. So I tried everything. I tried the humanitarian appeal. I tried the ecological appeals. I tried all these different arguments. Got nowhere. The guy's chasing the octopus around. And finally I said, I think it would be bad luck to kill that octopus. And that octopus was thrown over the side of the ship and back into the sea instantly. Sailors are the most superstitious people in the world because they are the people at the greatest risk in their daily work. This is where we hope to end up, the Straits of Salamis, where these oil tankers are today. There were 300 Greek triremes lined up facing the Persian, 1,000 in the Xerxes Armada on the other shore. Nobody has been able to do a systematic survey on these waters. We hope someday to get the permission of the Greek government and the involvement and collaboration of our Greek colleagues and go end to end. For that, we'll probably be getting into a new technology, magnetometers. There's enough magnetic material in those bronze rams that it would probably give a signal up through the mud. At any rate, it'll be a full court press for whoever is lucky enough to search on the seafloor under the site of the most important sea battle in all of human history. It is obligatory to end all underwater archaeological presentations with a sunset. And here you see the nose of our research vessel and the sun over the edge of the Mediterranean. But I cheated. This is a sunrise. And I like to think that even though we're 50 years on this year from the time when in 1960 an archaeologist first went underwater to examine a shipwreck in Poseidon's realm, we're still truly at the dawn of what underwater archaeologists is going to tell us about all those faraway places. Thanks very much.
What's the most interesting thing you have found in the Mediterranean?
I would say, in the Mediterranean.
We also found a small jar with the stopper in it, and it's still being analyzed over in the lab in Athens. But I guess from the thrill that that may yield some organic substances from 2,500 years back, that kind of thing is most exciting to me. A friend of mine, a guy named Brendan Foley, he's an underwater archaeologist, but his girlfriend is a Swedish DNA analyst, and they've worked out a system where they can do swabs on the inside of pots that have been on the seafloor, like you'd swab your cheek to get your DNA. If sunlight is never shown into the amphoras or the pots, you get the DNA of whatever organic substance was in there, wine, olive oil, fruit, whatever it was. So this will be unlocking secrets and all that. But for me, it was that humble little jar.
Back here?
Yeah.
Yes.
How was the paint on those urns? How was that preserved? I know.
The painting?
Yeah. The picture was painted on the urn.
Right. What you saw was an Athenian. It had turned kind of yellow, but that was actually a red figure. That is a slip. It's not technically a paint. Some of the clay was made into a slurry with a whole lot of water, put on with a brush to make all those figures, and then fired. And sometimes they were usually fired twice. And so it's actually part of the pot. It's part of the same clay that the pot's made of. It's in a more watery form, but it endures where if you had just painted it, it wouldn't have endured. The paint would usually have come up. So that's why it's what the ceramicists call a slip, and it does endure underwater.
Yeah, back there.
Darlene. Does everyone know we have an archaeologist in our midst right here?
Why is the Greek government hesitant to let you work in the stream?
I'm not totally clear. It is dangerous. It's disgusting. It's the outfall for Athens' sewer system, and they've only recently gotten in anything that treats the sewage. All those tankers pump their bilges. The water is toxic. We would have to dress up like astronauts, go down in these hazmat suits. And then there are little rivers and streams that flow into the Straits of Salamis, which almost guarantee that anything in the battle is probably at least 10 feet and maybe more under sludge. So for all these reasons, I think they don't think it's worth getting into. But also, I believe, you've probably all heard of a guy named Zahi Hawass. He's the Egyptian head of antiquities. He's seen one too many Indiana Jones movies. He wears a hat now. He's a cowboy. But he's dealing with a country, many of whom are Islamic people who had just see the pyramids, all the Egyptian materials as idols, and see them destroyed. So he's trying to convince Egyptian people in the street, this is ours, this is our heritage, we should all be excited by it. People come from all over the world to work on it. But he represents something. He represents the countries around the Mediterranean who have the great treasures starting to reject the right of people like me from America or somebody from Britain or Germany or France to go in and be the discoverer. I think the Greeks, although they probably don't have the funding or the equipment, the expertise to go in and do Salamis now, what's their hurry? It's not going away. And I believe for sites like that, unique sites, critical to their own history, critical to world history, we're getting to a point where the countries in whose sites those archaeological finds exist, they want to be the ones to bring them up. I mean, it would be the same thing if you were working at Gettysburg. Do we really want a Japanese team going in? And nothing against Japanese, but we certainly think American archaeology for Americans, and I think they're starting to think the same way. So I think we'll be accepted as collaborators, but not the chief director.
Back here.
Is there any site that you haven't been able to explore due to lack of technology or lack of funding that you would like to go to?
Gosh, that's an awfully good question. What I'd like to do is some of these submerged settlement sites. I was talking about this with Darlene at dinner. Back in the Ice Age, 15,000 years ago, all the world's water was 300 feet lower than it is now because it was all tied up in ice. Well, that means most of the big human habitations were out on the coast. There's a breed of diver, or cave divers, and I'm not one. And that's the technology that I regret I don't have. People are starting to find the mouths of caves. They're like Lascaux, they're like Altamira. Some of them even have incredible paintings on them, but they're only accessible to cave divers. And so I think there's a whole gigantic new chapter of human prehistory to be written, and only those who can get into caves underwater are going to be able to look at it. So that's the technique I wish I had.
Back here.
Yeah.
One more?
Yeah. Have you ever used GPR, ground penetrating radar?
I've never used it underwater. We use something similar with our sonar. Mostly of what we use underwater is sonar. You use it like a bat. You send down a ping. You've all seen World War II movies hunting submarines. It comes back to you, and you know how far away it is and what shape it is. We've got sonar now that can penetrate sediment and ping back off the first solid thing it hits. So, for instance, we know Greece was a beautifully forested country in the Archaic Age, 600 BC and before. Plato himself said, in the time of his grandfather, there were trees in Greece, near Athens, big enough to make ships and temples. It was all cut down in the time of his fathers to build those ships, those triremes. As soon as it was cut down, this is the oldest sort of ecological environmental warning in human literature. Plato said, with the trees gone, the rain washed the soil down to the sea. Now trees won't grow on those slopes. They never will again because they're bare rock. So he says, if we look at Attica, our own country as Athenians, we are seeing the skeleton of a once healthy body. Where'd that dirt go? It went in the sea. If we want to see how deep it is, in other words, is it worth going down and doing some excavation to get to bedrock, or in fact, are we in trouble? We got an impression of how much soil Greece lost. The sort of average depth of the apron of sludge that washed down from Greece in the last 2,500 years from the mountains into the sea, 40 feet. And we know that because of the sub-bottom profile, as we call them. But it is sonar, it isn't radar. Radar is, of course, radio waves. They don't behave underwater as well as sonar, so they haven't been used as much. But no doubt in the future, somebody's going to figure out how.
On behalf of WKU Libraries, I know you want to join with me and thanking Professor Hale for coming out en route to a very busy week. He leaves in the morning for Honolulu for a conference, and we're glad you could work this in on your schedule. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.